Thank you so much. I got to warn you ahead of time. I have, my voice is getting better. I had a cold, kind of a head flu last weekend and lasted all week. It's getting better, but I'm going to sound like this, very sultry and everything. So this is not what I usually sound like. My wife is not impressed. But anyway, so hopefully, I don't think I should cough too much, but hopefully it'll be okay, and you'll be able to think, okay, this guy doesn't always sound like a creeper, but just today. I'm so thankful to be here, and thankful for Pastor David inviting me here. Love your worship team, Trevor. Love Brent. Love your whole team. If I lived in this area, this is where I would attend church. So I hope that if you are visiting, and I hope that you'll come back next weekend, hear Pastor David as they continue this series through the book of Hebrews and talking about faith and how to live as a Christian. It's just incredibly important. This is a church where it's okay not to be okay. But, you know, we don't remain that way because we all try to follow Jesus and we help each other along. So I hope that you keep on coming here. And also, I love this area because it's in California. I've lived a lot of different places. I love California. But here's, I mean, they take all my money. We don't have any water. Other than that, I love it. I still really do. I'm married to my wife, Amy. She is a muy caliente Latina that goes to the gym every day and is like, just got a you know, six pack right here, just abs. And I think you can tell I watch a lot of TV. And, you know, eats right, eats healthy, and, you know, never in her wildest imagination did she ever think that her knight in shining armor would look like a cross between Dr. Evil, Fester, and Gru. I mean, this is this is her eye candy right here. We have two kids. We have my son, Joel, who's 12. He thinks he's invincible. We have my daughter, Rachel, who's 10. And she's 10 going on 19. And started rolling her eyes at me. I'm like, oh, now we're going to have issues. We're going to have issues now. And Amy's like, you don't know. Yeah. And I'm like, can I just get a hotel for the next 6 years? Or anyway, so we love it. And I have to fly a lot for my ministry that I do right now. And I don't like to fly. And hear me out on this. I'm not afraid of it. Okay, but I don't like it. Because other people are flying. And there are two places where people really let their grossness show. DMV, planes. And airports. Same thing as a plane. I mean, seriously, about 6 or 8 weeks ago, I was on this flight. We get up in the air, cruising altitude. The woman next to me takes off her shoe and sock and starts cutting her, clipping her toenails. And I usually don't say anything, except that requires something. I just looked at her and I said, really? And she said, oh, is this bothering you? And I was like, yes. I said, look down here. Your toenail is by my shoe. And she said, well, I guess I could wait till I get home tonight. And I said, you know what? Let's go with that plan. I'm a big fan of that plan. As a matter of fact, I'll wait tonight too. And I'll clip my toenails when nobody else is around. People walk barefoot into a commercial airliner bathroom. Like, and I'm just like, if you ever want to keep what little hope you have for humanity, don't go to the DMV. Don't go on an airplane, okay? You'll keep your hope for humanity. There's one time I remember I got on the plane. I was walking down the aisle, you know, the aisle of shame, walking down, and where everybody looks at you and once you make eye contact, people are like, you know, we're all, and once you see them staring at you, you're like, nobody wants to look at each other, even though we're gonna spend the next few hours together. In the back, I usually sit in the aisle seat, because if I have to use the bathroom, I want to go, and if something happens, I'm bailing, okay? And right next to me is the window seat, and there's this lady in the seat next to me, and literally, I'm not making this up, she's in the seat going, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no, 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 and I'm just like, oh, come on. And I'm like, is there any other seats? No. And you got on my phone, can I hop on another flight? No. I have to get there tonight where I'm going to speak, and I'm just like, please don't let her flip out. And I go sit down, and she's just, oh. And so I thought, man, I'm going to be nice and try to make conversation. Big mistake. I said, how are you doing, ma'am? And she goes, rah, rah. I don't know if you've ever had a grown adult that you don't know who's sitting really close to you growl at you. It's very disconcerting. And I'm thinking, I don't know what's going to happen when we take off. Hopefully she doesn't delay the plane, right? But we take off, and she goes to being a normal person. She's like, yes, I'd like a Diet Coke. I'm going to read my Agatha Christie book, everything like that. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe she's just having a bad day. We've all been there before. We've all been there where, you know, we just need to watch a Nicolas Cage movie or something. I don't know. And so when we start to descend, you can feel it. You know what I mean? And the plane turns this way. She freaks out. I wasn't expecting it. Stands up, and I'm not exaggerating, says, ISIS is on the plane. They have a bomb. And she tries to step over me to the center aisle because she wants to head for the emergency exit. Now, physically, if you don't understand physics, and physically as a human, when the plane is going that fast up in the air with the air, there's no way she could have pushed that door open, right? It's just impossible. But still, we don't need homegirl in the center of the aisle. Am I right? With what I'm getting ready to say, I want to clarify something so you don't think I'm a jerk. I have never laid a hand on a woman before, okay? And even my wife, you know, that Latina fire, she would beat me up. I'd be in the emergency room for 10 days, okay? However, this was the first time I ever laid a hand on a woman, because she's trying to get over me. And so I stood up, and I didn't like punch her in the throat or anything. That would have been interesting, no. But I grabbed her by her shoulders and I forced her down in her seat. And I look up and the flight attendants are looking at me. They're like, and I'm like, do your job. You know, get this woman a parachute and hit the eject button. And they're not doing anything. And she's like, no, I gotta go. And she keeps on trying to get up and I keep on pushing her down. She's like, no, you can't hold me here. I said, oh yes, I can. I don't think anybody's gonna argue. And she's like, well, we need to get off the plane. It's gonna crash. Let me just tell you something. Okay, I'm ADHD. A lot of the times I don't have a filter. I just say what I think, okay? You do not want me comforting you if you're dying or something bad has happened. Let me describe to you how I try to comfort her. She's like, I'm afraid we're gonna crash. I said, no, crashing is a good way to go, okay? Because if we crash, the pressure is gonna make you pass out and you'll be asleep. You won't even feel a thing by the time we hit the ground. It's great. Believe it or not, that did not help her. And then I'm trying to ground her. I'm like, what color is the seat in front of you? What does the seat feel like? You know, as my wife is a marriage and family therapist associate. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I'm trying to do all this stuff. And we land, and I get out to the gate, and it's the first time ever, and I travel a lot, that I actually have to sit down and, like, collect myself. And I've been through turbulence. I've been through airplanes where people have gas left and right, but I've never had to stop and collect myself. Because this woman wore me out, and then she comes walking by me. She's like, all right, well, it was so nice to meet you. It was a great flight. I gotta go to my next plane. I'm so excited, you know, who I'm gonna sit by. And I'm like, I wish I had that person's cell phone. I text them ahead of time. You know, and here's the thing. I felt sorry for this woman. Here's why. She was overwhelmed. She was hurting. There's anxiety there. There's something going on, and we've all been there before, right? Maybe you haven't been in an airplane seat going, okay? But maybe, just maybe, you find out that your kids, you've had these dreams for them, you've had these plans, and now your kids are saying, no, I want to go do this. And you're like, what is happening? I want to be in a relationship with this person. No, you don't. Yes, I do. And I'm over 18. Or maybe you've lived with your parents your whole life. Now you're moving out. Now you realize that it actually costs money for insurance. Costs money to do laundry. You start thinking, I didn't have it that bad. Maybe you woke up this morning, you look at the bank account, and it's like negative whatever. You start praying to God. You're like, God, you're part of the Red Sea. Can we just move the decimal point over, you know, a few over here? It's not going to zap that much energy from you. Maybe it's a bit more serious. Maybe your spouse has just been really hurtful. And for the first time, you're looking at your spouse. You're like, I don't know if I love you anymore. Maybe you lost a friend or a family member before their time. Maybe you struggle with a disorder, a disease, and people don't understand that about you. And so you are used to being misunderstood, maybe even bullied. Maybe people have caused you pain because of your ethnicity, because of your past. Maybe you are sitting in the consequences of your actions from the past. We always say, yeah, you know, we have to deal with the consequences. No, you don't. The consequences come and live with you. Take up residence in your life. And some of you are experiencing the consequences of somebody else's mistake. And you're in pain and you're hurting. Here's my question. What do we do when life gets overwhelming? What do we do when life gets so overwhelming that you don't know what to do, that you don't know where to go? Do you feel this pain? You feel this suffering, and you keep on praying to God. Can you get rid of this pain and God doesn't get rid of it? Keep on asking him, why don't you get rid of it? And he doesn't. And you still have your emotional issues. You're still having to learn how to live life without that person. You have this relationship change. You have this, you have that. Your career is not going in the direction that what you thought. A person that was a friend of yours last year is no longer a friend. You had to move somewhere that you didn't even want to move. Now you're suffering because you don't know anyone. Everyone around you is creepy. You're suffering because you think to yourself, oh, the Raiders are still a football team. How did that happen? Or maybe you're celebrating because they're no longer in California. I'm a Chiefs fan, by the way. Okay, that's fine. Now, our quarterback's awesome, so boo. What do you do when life gets overwhelming? Here's what I've learned about being a Christian. And you may or may not agree with this, and I still think I'm right. here's what I've learned. God doesn't always take away the pain. Sometimes he lets some of the pain remain. And so it's really ineffective to ask God to remove the pain. Sometimes he does. Most of the time, he doesn't. I mean, he let his own son die on the cross. He let Paul get his head cut off, let Peter get crucified upside down, let Isaiah get sawn in half. John the Baptist gets his head cut off. All the disciples, except for John, were killed for their faith. And John, I mean, he had a real treat in his 90s. He was like in a, you know, island prison all by himself. And yet we pray to God for this manufactured, comforted life. And I don't want you to feel sorry if you have nice things. I want you to have nice things. That's not my point. We think that God, some of the times, even if we don't want to admit it, we think that God is here to maintain our comfort. He's more interested in your faithfulness than your comfort. And actually, guess what? You can leverage pain to make you stronger, not weaker. And that's what I want to talk about today. So in just a second, we're going to have the verses on the screen here. In just a second, we're going to go all the way back to the very first book of the Bible written by this guy named Moses. And you may have, you know, heard of him before. He looked like Charlton Heston, went up this big mountain, got these tablets, got mad, broke them, and, you know, then had to go back up and get new ones, redo. And so he wrote the first five books of the Bible, and he wrote the book of Genesis, the very first book of the Bible. And we're going to learn about this guy named Jacob today. Now, Jacob had a very famous grandfather named Abraham. You may have heard of the Abrahamic religions. They're kind of descended from him, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. And so Abraham, or maybe you went to church a long time ago, you remember that song, Father Abraham, and I'm not going to sing it because it's annoying, okay? And you don't want me to. Like, I'm a horrible singer. If I'm going to sing anything, it's going to be Gangnam Style. But I'm not going to sing Father Abraham. And so then Abraham had a son named Isaac. And Isaac had two sons named Jacob and Esau. They're twins. Esau came out first. Okay? When he came out, he was literally red and hairy. And his name in Hebrew means red and hairy. They didn't plan for baby names, right? Nobody had written a book yet. They didn't think ahead. For some of you, your name would have been Alien or Conehead. My son's name would be Turtle if we operated like that right now. And then his brother Jacob, they weren't expecting him, comes out and he's literally grabbing onto the heel of his brother. And so they named him Heel Grabber. Not Bob. It's a better name than heel grabber because in Hebrew, Jacob not only means heel grabber, you know what it means? Liar. cheat, swindler, manipulator. Some of you are like, but my name's Jake. Jackie. Okay, it means something different today. You know, we don't think you're a liar. Maybe you are. I don't know. Your name is not even Jacob. You're living up to it. You just tell everybody that. But back then, like, they're not giving them a lot to live up to. You wouldn't name your kid Jacob like that back then. It's like having a son, like, what are you going to name him? Adolf. Little Adolf. No, nobody's going to do that, right? And so when they grow up, you know, Jacob lives up to his name, believe it or not, right? He becomes a liar and a cheater and a swindler, still a good guy, but he's a liar, he's a cheater, he's a swindler, tries to manipulate, tries to bargain, tries to control things and get his way. He swindles his brother Esau, who's the older one, by like 3 seconds, out of his inheritance and out of his birthright. Esau's so mad, he says, I'm going to kill you. Jacob takes that seriously, runs to a far distant country to go live with his uncle Laban, who's also a liar, a swindler, a cheater, that kind of thing. And so then he marries both of Laban's daughters. You do the math here. If he's his uncle, he's marrying his two cousins. Ick, right? And then if things weren't awkward enough, he marries both of their maidservants. It's not a family tree you want to crawl around in. Okay, it'd be a great reality TV show, but nobody wants to volunteer for that. And they have all these kids. Jacob acquires all this wealth and soldiers and servants and money and camels and tents and everything you can imagine. And then he ends up swindling his Uncle Laban because his Uncle Laban is trying to swindle him. They get together, they make up, and then he and his family start out on this long journey in the desert. Jacob sends out many scouts in front of him like he normally would. Some of the scouts come back and they said, hey, this guy is coming. He's about a day's ride away. His name is Esau. He wants to talk to you. And it's like, oh. What was the last interaction? Esau said, I'm going to kill you. You ever been busted? You ever had your past show up? You ever been out eating with your wife and then an ex-girlfriend walks in? You didn't tell her about it. You're like, oh, no. Or maybe the other way around. You ever hope that somebody won't find out that secret or somebody's like, hey, why'd you put this on Twitter? You mean 10 years ago on Twitter? Yeah, 10 years ago. You're like, no, because I'm dumb. Sometimes your past, it always shows up. You can't bury it. That's why honesty and authenticity and owning things is the best. And so here's what he does first. He prays. That's the first thing we should do when life hits us. Jacob prays, and I want to read his prayer to you in Genesis 32, beginning with verse 9, because it's awesome. Listen to this. O God of my grandfather Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, you told me, return to your own land and to your relatives, and you promised me I will treat you kindly. I am not worthy of all the unfailing love and faithfulness you have shown me, your servant. And when I left home and crossed the Jordan River, I owe nothing except a walking stick. And now my household fills up 2 large camps. Oh Lord, please rescue me from the hand of my brother Esau. I am afraid that he is coming to attack me along with my wives and children. But you promised me I will surely treat you kindly and I will multiply your descendants until they become as numerous as the sands along the seashore. Too many to count. That's a great prayer, right? And then here's what he does. He puts together all this stuff to send to Esau. Sends 2 or 3 groups ahead of him of like money and people and, you know, camels and horses and, you know, whatever they had back then. You know, iPhones and hopefully not a Samsung. And it says in verse 17 that he gave the instructions to the men leading the first group. When my brother Esau meets you, he will ask, whose servants are you? Where are you going? Who owns these animals? You must reply, they belong to your servant Jacob. They are a gift for his master Esau. Look, he is coming right behind us. No, this is great, okay? He's prayed, God the priority. He's, you know, making right what he stole from his brother. Except we find out a couple of verses down, that's not the case. Middle of verse 20, we get kind of an inner glance of his thoughts. It says, Jacob thought, I will try to appease him by sending gifts ahead of me. When I see him in person, perhaps he will be friendly to me. So the gifts were sent on ahead while Jacob himself spent the night in the camp. And then verse 22 says, during the night, Jacob got up and he took his two wives and his two servant wives, his 11 sons, and he crossed the Jabbok River with them. After taking them to the other side, he sent over all of his possessions. Okay, that made his prayer worthless. When it says, hey, if I send all this stuff over there, maybe I'll appease my brother. He's not trying to repay what he stole. He's not trying to be kind. You know what he's trying to do? Control the situation. I'm trying to bargain. I'm trying to work it out. I'm trying to be sly. I'm being strategic. I'm making stuff happen. I got this under control. Ever been there before? When all of a sudden you try to control something, you're like, I've got control. You know what? There's this little nasty thing all of us have and other people have called free will. And it means people can do whatever they want. And rarely do people ever listen to you and do what you say. Say, Caleb, how do you know this? I have children. I mean, seriously, that makes his prayer worthless because his prayer is just another checklist. It's not the thing he's turning to. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't think through and plan and everything. But look where his main focus was. If I pay him off, he'll leave me alone. No. Prayer should have been the main thing and everything else should have supported that. But his prayer is worthless. You know, it's just another checklist. You know, pray, get people together, take as much as you want to pay them off, take my kids and my family and all my possessions across the other side of the river so if he kills me, at least my legacy will live on. Dude, guy's selfish. Like Caleb, he's trying to save his family. Yeah, that's cool and everything, but he's still selfish. He's like Rose in the Titanic when she's on that door by herself and leaves Jack / Leo in the ocean to die. Well, only one person could fit there. No, she's selfish. Anyway, that's a whole nother sermon. I want to warn you, if you're not used to reading the Bible, what we're getting ready to read is probably going to seem a little weird to you. And some of you are like, Caleb, don't call the Bible weird. I'm not calling it creepy, bad, strange. I'm just saying what we're getting ready to read is weird. And for some of you, you're like, well, I know this story. It's not weird, okay? It's not weird to you because you've read it umpteen times or you've been a Christian since God was a boy. But imagine reading what I'm getting ready to read for the first time. When God, who's outside of time and is timeless, steps into the arena of time, our world, we call that supernatural, outside of nature. It's what we call miracles. And we're about ready to see a theophany, an appearing of God in a human body in the Old Testament. And trust me, it can't help but be a little awkward, stuff that we're not used to seeing. So here's what happens. It really kind of starts off as a horror movie, if you think about it. Verse 24, this is at nighttime. This left Jacob all alone in the camp, and a man came and wrestled with him until dawn began to break. And when the man saw that he would not win the match, he touched Jacob's hip and wrenched it out of his socket. Then the man said, let me go, for dawn is breaking. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. What is your name? The man asked. He replied, Jacob. Verse 28, your name will no longer be Jacob, the man told him. From now on, you will be called Israel, because you have fought with God and with men and have won. Please tell me your name, Jacob said. Why do you want to know my name? The man replied. Then he blessed Jacob there. Jacob named the place Peniel, which means face of God. For he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been spared. The sun was rising as Jacob left Peniel, and he was limping because of the injury to his hip. Even today, the people of Israel don't eat the tendon near the hip socket because of what happened that night when the man strained the tendon of Jacob's hip. Okay, that's awkward, right? Let me explain to you in a different way. Here's what I think happened, and this is 100% my own opinion. I think Jacob was pacing back and forth on the riverbed, on the beach here. He's thinking, what else do I need to do? I prayed, I've done this, I've done this. He's just thinking, he's trying to control everything. And then this dude comes, capital D, right, dude, because we know it's God. This dude comes out of the shadows and attacks him. I mean, do you know? That's like my worst fear. Waking up in the middle of the night, somebody's in the house. My wife talks in her sleep. She creeps me out. I remember this one time, she sat up straight in bed at 3 a.m., you know, when everything's dark and like it's like creepily dark. And I'm like, I kind of wake up and I'm half awake, half asleep. She's fully, you know, asleep, you know, and she still has her eyes closed and she looks at me and she's sitting up, I'm laying down. She looks at me and she goes, "He's here." And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, who's here?" And like, I'm in my pajamas, I'm a mess, I don't have my contacts in, I'm, you know, I don't even have a gun, I'm grabbing a baseball bat and a pencil, and I'm like, you know, "Who's here? Amy, wake up." And she goes, "He's in the living room." I'm like, "What?" I'm like, "Is Chucky down there and Freddy Krueger or Hannibal Lecter?" And then she falls down, goes to sleep. I'm like, Amy, wake up. She's asleep. And I'm like sitting there, I'm like, you know, you know what I mean when you're half awake, half asleep, you don't know what's real, you're like. And then it kind of dawns on me that, you know, she's freaking out. And so I'm like, okay, I'll go back to sleep. Wake up in the morning, I'm like, "Do you remember what happened?" She's like, "Kind of. I was having a dream that Jesus came to our house." Didn't sound like Jesus. Sound like a serial killer was down there. It's creepy at nighttime, in the dark, when you can't see anything. And I can't imagine how scared Jacob must have been. And so this guy starts wrestling with Jacob. And they're wrestling, and Jacob isn't giving up. Guy literally just touches this hip socket. And Jacob's hip wrenches out of joint. I don't know if you've ever seen somebody where that's happened or you've ever had that happen. You can't stand afterwards. Jacob falls to his knees, maybe all the way to the ground, and he either grabs onto this guy's waist or he grabs on to God's feet. Ironically, God put him in a position where he was fully relying on God for the very first time in his life. Because now he didn't have a plan. He didn't have a strategy. He didn't have anything to bargain. He didn't have anything to deal with. God walks away, he's stuck. It's kind of like what Mike Tyson says. Everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And right now, he doesn't have a plan. He knows that the only way he can make it through is to fully rely and depend and to trust and to surrender and yield to God. And he says, and then God says, "Hey, let me go. It's almost daybreak." Now, he's not a colon. God is not a vampire. What he's saying, when you look at it in Hebrew, it's almost sarcastic. It's kind of like, "Hey, you need to let me go. You got things to do today. You know, your brother's coming, right? Yeah, you got an appointment with him. And, you know, so I got to go and you got things to do. And so you just hang out right here." And Jacob says, "No, I will not let you go unless you bless me, unless you give me the strength to do this and to survive." God asks him a very pointed question that we just read. We're like, huh? But it would have pierced Jacob's heart. He says, "What's your name?" And back in those days, if you knew somebody's name, people believed that you had power over them. So for you to give someone your name, you were surrendering to them, surrendering the power that you think you had over them. For the first time, he's forcing Jacob to deal with who he is. He's forcing Jacob to look in the mirror. And in the text it says, "My name is Jacob," and I think that's what happened, but I think maybe there are some more emotions that we don't have captured in here. I can see Jacob saying, for the first time, he's having to own it. He's saying, he's realizing that God doesn't deal, he doesn't bargain, God doesn't negotiate. It is God's plan or no plan. God doesn't lie, he doesn't cheat, he doesn't swindle, he doesn't try to manipulate. And so Jacob has to own it. And I could see him saying, "My name is Jacob. My name is Jacob. I'm a heel grabber. I'm a liar. I've been a liar since I was born. I'm a cheater. I'm a manipulator. I try to, you know, curve things my way. I try to get my way. My name is Jacob. I'm a cheater. I bargain. I deal. I trade. You can't trust me. I'm a liar. My name is Jacob." My opinion is, I think in that moment, if we could see this human embodiment of God, the face, I think it would have gone from stern to compassion. God has more compassion than he does anger. I think when he surrendered in that moment, just like the prodigal son's father wrapped his arms around him before he even could finish his speech, God said, no, you are no longer that because you've owned it. Your name is now Israel. Literally in Hebrew, God fights. And then Jacob says, well, what's your name? Personally, I interpret that as Jacob trying to go back to his muscle habit. He's trying to go back. You ever felt like you had a toxic habit or a hang-up beat? You're like, yes, finally. And then the next day, you're like, huh? And God healed him enough where he could walk, but he left a limp. Because sometimes I think that God allows scars to remain and some of the pain to remain so that we would be reminded of our surrender to him and of his grace in our life. Here's what I want you to know. When you feel pain and suffering, instead of saying, God, remove the pain, remove the suffering, and you can say that, there's nothing wrong with it, maybe he will. But I think this is a better principle to live by. True freedom is found in total surrender. True freedom is found in total surrender. If you want to be strong, quit being independent and start being dependent on God. Grab onto his waist, grab onto his ankles. You are not strong enough to stand on your own. You're like, oh, Caleb, you have no idea. I did this and I did this, I did this. Yeah, and one day you're gonna be dead. You're gonna be 6 feet under, and people are gonna eat potato salad after they cry about you. Same thing with me. You're like, oh man, that's weird. Yes, because guess what? You are not as strong as you think, and neither am I. If you really want to be strong, give up your life to Jesus. He will make you stronger than you ever could. You see, we believe that Jesus Christ died on the cross for your sins so that you no longer experience the eternal consequences for your sin, and that the Holy Spirit comes and lives inside of you and guides you and strengthens you, God himself, and that you are also included in the church, which is a huge family, and that you get eternal life. How is that not strong? Like, you should go to the gym. I know I should. We should do all this stuff, take care of ourselves. But one day, worms will be crawling through your body. Unless you get cremated, and then just you be fluff. But that's not who you are. Your spirit is who you are. How do we do that? How do we live this out? Well, here are three quick things. True freedom is found in total surrender. Here's the first thing I want you to do. Quit bargaining and wrestling with God. If you want to be free, quit bargaining and wrestling with God. Now, some of you are like, no, Caleb, I can tell you I don't do that. And I say, tell the truth, shame the devil, liar, liar, pants on fire. You do too. No, I don't. Yes, you do. Have you ever prayed this prayer, God? If you will, then I will. If you will help this person to like me, I will go to church every single weekend for the rest of the year, except for those 2 weekends when I'm on vacation. And that one weekend, you know, when I'm in Tahiti. And that other weekend, you know, when my friend's in town. And, you know, God, you're really asking a lot. Wow, it got really quiet in here all of a sudden. You ever said, God, if you give me this job, I will tithe 10%. Really? You think tithing is based on the amount you make? No, it's based on the posture of your heart. We don't obey God out of obligation. We obey God because we love him. Okay, God, I promise if you get me out of this, you know, I promise that I will eat cauliflower the rest of my life. Well, number one, you should never do that. That's horrible. My wife loves CPK's cauliflower crust. She's like, it tastes just like the real thing. No, it doesn't. You know what it tastes like, Amy? It tastes like baked cauliflower with marinara sauce and mozzarella. It tastes like cyanide. You ever heard somebody pray? You just tell that their prayers are trying to impress everybody else because they're using every Hebrew name of God that nobody knows. They could be making that up and you wouldn't know it. Or they're like quoting all this stuff to God as if Like, he's like, you know, I wrote the Bible. Yeah, I got that. You said in this verse, yes, I know. I said that. It's just so you don't have to be real. The more you bargain, wrestle with God, the further away from God you move. Second thing, learn how to walk wounded. Learn how to walk wounded. Rick Warren has always said this a lot, and then after his son, Matthew, died, he said, if you want to walk with Jesus, you gotta learn how to walk with a limp. You gotta learn how to walk wounded. Charles Spurgeon, who is one of the first megachurch pastors in the 1800s over in the UK, said, before God greatly uses someone, God greatly breaks that person. You gotta learn how to walk wounded. The key is not running away from your pain, running away from potential pain. The enemy is running away from that. The key is not having pain influence your attitude and your relationships and your faith and your character. There's not a single person in here who isn't struggling with something. Even Plato, the philosopher, said, be kind, for everyone you see is fighting a difficult battle. You see, when you look at the people in the Bible, even Jesus in Hebrews, where it says he learned obedience through suffering. You look at the people in the Bible, you look at the, you know, the good leaders of history, every single one of them endured a lot of pain to get where they are. Didn't just happen. You know how you get stronger? You will only become strong to the amount of threshold of pain you can handle. If you want to become stronger as a person and in your faith, increase your threshold for pain. How do you do that? You face your pain. You don't run away from it, because when you face your pain, you've got God behind you saying, I got this. God has never promised to make the pain or the suffering go away. Sometimes he will. It will get to be less. God said, hey, I will walk with you through it, through the fire, through the floodwaters, through the chaos. I've got you. Last thing real quick is this. Ask God for a new name. God renamed Jacob. He renamed Saul to Paul when he became a Christian. And the book of Revelation says that in heaven, we will each be given a white stone with a new name. And by the way, you still have a new name right now. It's called forgiven. It's called child of God, daughter of God. It's called son of the Most High. It's son of the King. Okay, it's called royalty. It's called an inheritor. Okay? It's called redeemed. You have a name and you're not living by it. When you allow your pain to be your master, you become a victim, you become bitter, you become angry. Nobody wants to hang out with you. Okay? For some of you, you've never accepted that name. You're gonna have a chance in just a second to step forward and accept that name. We're gonna have people down here. If you wanna ask questions about Jesus, no committal, but you just want to ask about Jesus, you can come down in just a second. We're going to give you that opportunity. If you never sealed the deal and gotten baptized before, we're going to give you that chance. That could even happen today. If you need to get back on track with God, or if you are just dealing with a lot of pain and you need prayer, we're going to have people down here waiting to pray for you. Why? Because true freedom is found in total surrender. You will never be as strong as you could be until you fully rely on God with your emotions, with everything. Keep your thoughts on him, not on yourself. Proverbs 4:23 in the NCV says, be careful what you think, for your thoughts run your life. There's a reason why, over and over again, Paul and other New Testament writers said, keep your mind on things above. Otherwise, you will drift towards the negative. You have too much potential. Let's surrender together. Let me pray for you. Lord, thank you so much for today. Thank you for this message. For anyone that needs to come forward, I pray that they would do that and walk down the aisles and talk to someone if they have questions about Jesus, want to get baptized, need to get their life on track, or just need prayer for pain. Something happened today or this week, or something they can't let go of, someone they can't forgive, someone that keeps gossiping about them, somebody that has threatened them. Pray they come forward. In your son's name I pray, amen. If you guys will stand with me, we're going to sing together. And as we sing, this is your opportunity to step forward. Don't let fear control you. Step forward. And let's start surrendering together.